The bar was not loud when he died. There was no final confrontation between two men who understood each other's mythology. No last exchange of words. No drawn weapons. No standoff. No acknowledgement that something significant was ending. The gunman came in from behind. He got close. Close enough that missing was not a concern. And he fired several times into George Spence, and then he was gone before anyone in that room had fully processed what they were witnessing. George Spence was known across Kingston as Feathermop, named for the gray locks that hung from his head in the thick, undisciplined way of something that had never been tamed. He was a Rastafarian and a political enforcer, which in the Jamaica of the 1970s was not quite the contradiction it sounds. He had terrorized this city for nearly a decade. He had ridden at the front of a convoy of 30 motorcycles through the streets of central Kingston, and never once been arrested for the things the police, the politicians, and the public all knew he had done. He had been to Cuba on the Prime Minister's plane. He had won government contracts. He had walked into the offices of the Kingston and St. Andrew Corporation and threatened the lives of civil servants until they gave him money. And the men who could have stopped him had chosen not to, because he was useful to them. And useful men in Garrison, Jamaica, did not go to prison. He was killed before the 1976 election. He never saw what the system he served was building toward. But to understand what Feathermop was, and what his death meant, and why the silence around his killing was so complete and so deliberate, you have to understand how the Garrison was born, not as an accident of poverty, not as an inevitable consequence of inequality, but as a conscious, engineered political technology deployed by men in suits who needed the streets to vote a certain way and were willing to pay any price to make that happen. It began with land. When the JLP held power in the 1960s, a minister named D.C. Tavares built the first political garrison and filled it with party loyalists. Edward Sega, then Minister of Social Development and Welfare, went further. He demolished Bacco Wall, a settlement of Rastafarians, squatters, and the displaced who had been promised repatriation to Africa by Norman Manley, and built Tivoli Gardens on its rubble. He packed those new concrete buildings with JLP supporters, and drew the line in the earth that would define West Kingston for the next 50 years. The Rastafarians who were driven from that land were considered loyal to the PNP. Their removal was not incidental. It was the point. The PNP watched it happen and took notes. When Michael Manley won the 1972 election and ended a decade of JLP governance, his Minister of Construction and Housing was a man named Anthony Spaulding. Spaulding built Arnett Gardens, a sprawling low-income development on the southern edge of Kingston, and did to it exactly what Siega had done to Tivoli Gardens, filled it with PNP supporters, cleared out anyone whose loyalty was doubtful, and drew new garrison lines across the map of the city. The residents did not call it Arnett Gardens. They called it Concrete Jungle. The name was accurate. In the process of constructing his political base, Spaulding's enforcers drove the original occupants of nearby Trenchtown, people who had been there for years, people with no political crime other than belonging to the wrong party, out of their homes entirely. Those displaced families eventually resettled in the hills of St. Catherine, in an area that became known as Central Village. They carried nothing with them, except the lesson that in Garrison, Jamaica, your house was not your house. It belonged to the party, and when the party decided it needed the space for someone more useful, you left or you suffered. Numbered among Spaulding's political enforcers in Concrete Jungle were two men who would come to define the PNP's street machinery for the next decade. One was Winston Blake, known as Bury Boy, the charismatic face of the operation, the man whose funeral would draw 20,000 mourners. The other was George Spence, Feathermop, the iron fist behind the public legend. Together they commanded a gang of approximately 30 men, all riding Honda motorcycles, who operated across central Kingston, south St. Andrew, and southwest St. Andrew, from 1967 through 1976. The motorcycles were not just transportation. They were the tactical signature of the operation. A white van would pull up to a location, a political meeting, a construction site, a party office, a community, and then 30 Hondas would appear behind it in formation, two men to a bike, faces without expression, executing whatever they had come to execute, and then disappearing into the Kingston streets before any response was possible. Eyewitnesses who spoke to the Gleaner at the time described the silence of it, 60 men arriving and departing, and never uttering a single word. From 1967 through 1976, this convoy was the instrument through which the PNP secured constituencies that could not have been secured by knocking on doors. By 1974, with Manley having declared his government's commitment to democratic socialism and the Cold War politics of the region, drawing Jamaica's internal conflict into international alignments, neither party had fully anticipated. The gang's operations widened. In November of that year, Burry Boy and Feathermop led a mob that shot a JLP activist, attacked mourners at the funeral of another JLP loyalist, and physically mobbed opposition members of parliament when they attempted to enter Gordon House. Three separate incidents in a single month. Three separate acts of political violence that any functioning law enforcement system would have investigated and prosecuted. None resulted in arrest. Weeks later, the same gang broke up a strike by port workers represented by the National Workers Union, which was the PNP's own affiliated union. The union's leader, Trevor Munro, received multiple chop wounds across his body and was seriously injured. The men who were supposed to be protecting PNP interests had turned their machetes on the PNP's own labor movement, not because the politics had shifted, because the gang had grown large enough and protected enough that it no longer needed to observe the internal logic of the arrangements that had created it. This is where the system's central failure becomes visible. A political enforcer who cannot be controlled is not an enforcer. He is a liability that has been given a weapon and told it is a tool. Manley's government knew this. His cabinet knew this. The party knew this. And the response was not to withdraw protection or pursue accountability. The response was to take Burry Boy and Feathermop on the plane to Cuba. They were included in the Prime Minister's official diplomatic delegation to Fidel Castro. The two most feared political gang leaders in central Kingston, men whose names appeared in police reports alongside stabbings and choppings and the occupation of government offices, were given seats in the entourage of a head of state visiting one of the most politically significant allies his government would ever cultivate. At a reception hosted by Castro, pork was served. Cuba's cuisine makes no exception for Rastafarian dietary restrictions. Feathermop, who regarded pork as forbidden, is reported to have erupted into a rage and kicked over the tables. The detail lodged itself in the oral history of the trip and has been recounted consistently across multiple sources in the decades since. It reveals something essential. George Spence did not understand the performance of power. He understood only its exercise. The Prime Minister of Jamaica could navigate a diplomatic reception in Havana. Feathermop could not. He was a man who had been given impunity for so long that he had forgotten the difference between the streets of concrete jungle, where his behavior had no consequences, and the reception hall of a revolutionary government, where it had plenty. And still, nothing happened. He flew back to Kingston. He kept riding. Back in Jamaica, the contracts continued. Feathermop was awarded a government contract for cleaning the Lilford Gully after flood damage. When the details came to public light, it emerged that he had been paid twice the value of the contract and had failed to pay the workers who performed the actual cleaning. The scandal was embarrassing enough that Manley was reportedly forced to call in the police to investigate. Whether any arrest followed, or whether the investigation reached any conclusion at all, was never clearly established in the public record. What was clearly established, through the testimony of former KSA workers speaking on the record years later, was the pattern that surrounded the contract. Feathermop was a man who would come into the KSA office and bad up the people for money and threaten them life, one former worker recalled. Him was a known troublemaker who was protected by the big man. The big man did not intervene. The gully contract was one transaction in a much larger economy of impunity, and the people who ran that economy had decided the operational cost of Feathermop was still less than the electoral benefit he delivered. Then Bury Boy died. On March 14, 1975, Winston Blake was driving along Darling Street when a car pulled alongside him. The men inside fired more than once into his head. He was approximately 28 years old. His funeral drew over 20,000 mourners, including Michael Manley and several of his cabinet ministers. As the procession moved past Tivoli Gardens on its way to Maypen Cemetery, the convoy came under gunfire from the JLP garrison. Even 20,000 people grieving in the street were not enough to pause the war for a single afternoon. 6 weeks before Bury Boy's death, there had been a rumor moving through the offices of the Ministry of Housing. A civil servant had started asking questions. Careful questions, the kind a man asks when he has found something in the numbers that does not add up and is not yet sure how dangerous it is to say so out loud. The questions concerned payments connected to a government contract, and the name connected to those payments was Winston Blake's. The civil servant stopped asking questions. The manner in which that happened has never been publicly explained. With Bury Boy gone, Feathermop stood alone at the top of the structure they had built together, and something shifted in the geometry of the arrangement. The political bosses who had protected them when they operated as a pair now looked at what remained, an erratic, unpredictable, increasingly autonomous enforcer who had embarrassed the party in Havana, defrauded the government on a public contract, intimidated civil servants with impunity, and made himself a symbol of every accusation the JLP was leveling against Manley's administration and began calculating differently. Feathermop's obnoxious manners, as the Jamaica Observer's 2008 account described it, had earned him the ire of power brokers inside the PNP who had previously tolerated him. The patience of the men who had signed his contracts and shielded him from prosecution was not infinite. It simply had a threshold, and by mid-1975, George Spence had crossed it. He was killed approximately 6 months after Bury Boy, cut down in a bar by a gunman who came up behind him without warning, fired several shots and left. No dramatic confrontation with a rival Don. No public acknowledgement of what his death meant or who it served. The garrison swallowed it, the way garrisons absorb every inconvenient truth, with silence and with speed. No one was ever charged. The question of who ordered it, or whether it was ordered at all, or whether it was the inevitable consequence of a decade of enemies accumulating on every side of him, was never publicly answered. What is documented is this. By the time Feathermop died, he had made enemies inside the PNP's own political machinery, enemies among the JLP enforcers of Rema and Tivoli Gardens, and enemies among the civil servants and union workers his gang had terrorized. The list of people who benefited from his death was long and crossed party lines. And here is the question that still does not have a clean answer, and that the people who were in those rooms in 1975 have never been made to answer directly. Was the gunman in that bar sent by the party that had finally grown tired of managing him, or by the rivals who had been waiting for his guard to drop? The silence that followed his death was too complete, too uniform, too unbothered to have been accidental. Jamaica, if you are listening to this from London, or New York, or Toronto, or Miami, from the cities the garrison diaspora built when it carried Kingston's wounds across the Atlantic and planted them in new soil, you need to sit with what that silence means. Because that silence did not end when Feathermop fell off his stool in that bar. It became policy. It became the institutional template for how Jamaica's political class would relate to every enforcer that came after him. Use them, protect them, and when they become too expensive, remove them and say nothing. Michael Manley declared the state of emergency on June 19, 1976. The official justification was that Jamaica was under siege from foreign-backed destabilization, unexplained fires in Trenchtown, unusual patterns of violence designed to create panic, the psychological warfare strategies that Manley himself would quote from the U.S. Army manual in his book Struggle in the Periphery, and the evidence that external forces were working against his government was not fabricated from nothing. The CIA's activities in Jamaica during this period were reported by Newsday investigative journalists Ernest Volkman and John Cummings, who documented that the CIA had plotted Manley's assassination, with attempts allegedly scheduled for July 14, 1976. The Cold War was not metaphorical in Kingston. It was operational, but the state of emergency was also something else. Approximately 1,000 people were detained, including prominent JLP members. Claude Massup was imprisoned at Up Park Camp. Carl Baya Mitchell was taken off the street. Curly Locks, the top JLP enforcer in Rama, lost his freedom while the election campaign ran its course. The PNP's garrison machinery, already missing Burry Boy and Feathermop, but still operational in their absence, moved through the election period with its primary rivals detained by legal order. The New York Times reported on July 15, 1976, that emergency rule had reduced political violence. It had. It had also removed from circulation the men most capable of countering the PNP's street operations in their strongest constituencies. Prominent JLP members at the time stated plainly that the SOE was designed to rig the election by incarcerating the opposition supporters who would have resisted irregularities. Manley's supporters argued equally plainly that the violence was real, the destabilization was real, and the emergency was necessary. Both claims contain evidence. Neither cancels the other. What neither side has ever fully answered is why the machinery of emergency detention fell so cleanly and so completely along partisan lines. Manley won the December 15, 1976 election in a landslide. The garrison constituencies delivered. The street system that Burry Boy and Feathermop had spent a decade building, the ethnic cleansing of Tavares Gardens, the forced displacement of Trenchtown residents, the motorcycle raids, the chopped union leaders, the intimidated civil servants, the government contracts that circled back as campaign infrastructure, all of it delivered its final return on investment in December 1976. The two men who had built it were already in the ground. The generation they represented was ending. What came next was not the continuation of their model, it was its mutation. When Claude Massup was released from detention after the SOE, and then killed by police in February 1979, the structure he had held together in West Kingston collapsed almost immediately. Lester Lloyd Jim Brown Koch stepped into the vacuum. Koch was not a political enforcer in the way Massup had been, not in the way Burry Boy and Feathermop had been. He was not primarily interested in delivering votes. He was interested in what the early 1980s made newly available to ambitious armed men in the Caribbean, cocaine. The shower posse that Koch built out of Tivoli Gardens was structured differently from anything that had preceded it. It had cells in New York, Miami, Kansas City, Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, and other American cities. It had a management tier operating internationally under Vivian Blake, while Koch handled Jamaican operations from inside the JLP's own constituency. It was a transnational criminal enterprise that used the garrison infrastructure, the community loyalty, the territorial control, the political impunity that had been built and maintained over two decades of partisan violence, and repurposed it entirely for narco profit. The political bosses who had once directed men like Feathermop now found themselves in a different relationship with the men who ran the garrisons. The dons of the 1980s did not need the politicians to survive. The politicians needed the dons. The direction of dependency had reversed, and there was no mechanism to reverse it back, because every mechanism that might have worked, law enforcement, prosecution, community accountability, had been systematically undermined by the same patronage arrangements that had made Feathermop immune to arrest for a decade. The 1980 election killed more than 800 people. It was the bloodiest electoral campaign in Jamaican history, and it was built on the foundation that the 1970s had laid, garrison by garrison, contract by contract, Motorcycle raid by motorcycle raid. The men who stuffed ballot boxes and drove opponents from polling stations in 1980 had learned their craft from the generation of Bury Boy and Feathermop. They had simply removed the political loyalty from the equation and kept the violence. Academic researchers studying the Garrison model have documented the structural logic of what happened with clinical precision. The Garrison was never an accident. It was a deliberate process. The party in power allocates houses to supporters, homogenizes the community by driving out the minority, and maintains one-party dominance through the enforcement of men whose protection depends on the party's continued power. Both parties built it. Both parties maintained it. Both parties used it. And both parties eventually lost control of what they had built, because the system they created was designed to serve power, and power in Jamaica shifted from the politicians to the possess, sometime around the moment that cocaine arrived and made the Dons richer than any government contract could make them. George Spence's gray locks were somewhere in May Penn Cemetery when that happened, but he was part of the genealogy of it. Not the man who completed the design, but the man who proved its most dangerous property. That when a state creates an enforcer and grants him impunity, it does not create a tool. It creates a precedent. And precedents, in Garrison Jamaica, do not die on bar floors. They evolve, multiply, and eventually come to govern the people who thought they were governing them. The gunman who killed Feathermop was never identified. Nobody was charged. Nobody was made to explain the timing or the motive, or who stood to benefit from the silence that followed. The party that had protected him did not publicly mourn him. The community he had terrorized and in its way also protected absorbed his death with the practiced speed of people who had learned not to attach their survival to any single man. And the white van was still out there somewhere. The Hondas were still running. The formation was still intact, just with different riders, different bosses, different destinations, and no politician's hand on the throttle anymore. So here is the question this story leaves you with, and there is no comfortable answer waiting on either side of it. Feathermop was a monster, but he was a monster the system built, financed, protected, and then discarded when the protection became inconvenient. So when you look at what Jamaica became in the 1980s, and the 1990s, and every decade after, when you look at the posses, and the extraditions, and the Garrison wars that claimed hundreds of lives every election cycle, do you blame the men who pulled the triggers? Or do you blame the men in the suits who handed them the guns, signed the contracts, took them to Cuba, and then stood at the funeral pretending they had no idea how any of it happened? And if you are Jamaican, if you grew up in one of those garrisons, or left one, or sent money back to someone still living inside one, ask yourself this. Was there ever a version of this story where the party you supported was the one that chose differently? Or did both parties, the moment power was within reach, make exactly the same calculation, build exactly the same machine, and simply tell themselves that their version of it was justified? Was Feathermop inevitable, or was he a choice?